Welcome to World Policy on Air, a weekly podcast from the pages and website of World Policy Journal, published by the nonprofit World Policy Institute in New York. I'm David Alpern. In this week's program, posted December 9, 2016, we talk with Hong Kong native and activist Jeffrey Ngo about a recent WPI blog post he co-authored on the continuing struggle for autonomy and democracy on the island and a new historical approach. We'll also point out top features in the WPJ fall issue, cover theme History's Ghosts. You're listening to World Policy on Air. Now this. Thousands protested in the streets of Hong Kong last month against an expected local court ruling directed by Beijing that blocked two young pro-autonomy activists from taking seats in the legislature because they sidestepped the precisely worded loyalty oath required by China. It was the most dramatic such demonstration since the failed Umbrella Movement in 2014. A 79-day sit-in against Beijing's insistence on pre-screening candidates to be the island's chief executive, despite a 1997 agreement to avoid Chinese political intervention for 50 years under terms of Hong Kong's basic law, that's its mini-constitution as a special administrative region of China. Days after the court ruling, Republican Senators Marco Rubio of Florida and Tom Cotton of Arkansas offered at least moral support to the continuing autonomy campaign with a bill spawned by earlier Chinese arrests of five Hong Kong booksellers. It would allow the U.S. to freeze assets and bar entry to those behind, quote, surveillance, abduction, detention, or forced confessions and other actions suppressing basic freedoms. But it remains to be seen if the legislation will win support from an even more firmly Republican-controlled Congress and from GOP President-elect Donald Trump after both his tirades against China and reportedly warm conversation with President Xi Jinping. Meanwhile, Umbrella Movement leader Joshua Wong and Hong Kong colleague Jeffrey Ngo, now a master's degree candidate at New York University, have opened a new front in the fight for autonomy in the island's colonial and post-colonial archives. They co-authored an article about it for World Policy Journal headlined, Reclaiming Our Right to Self-Determination in Post-Umbrella Hong Kong. And Ngo talked about it for this podcast. Jeffrey Ngo, welcome to World Policy on Air.
Hi.
History might seem a strange battleground for determining the future, but your key point is that so much of Hong Kong's changing status was determined in secret. Remind us of the negotiations between colonial ruler Great Britain and the People's Republic of China.
Hong Kong has, since the mid-19th century, been a British colony, and when the United Nations was established in 1945, one of its core ideals is to grant, you know, all peoples the right to self-determination. And so in 1946, the year after, they began cataloging a list of non-self-governing territories, of which Hong Kong was rightly included. But by the 1970s, by 1972, actually, the United Nations decided to remove Hong Kong from that list. And so Hong Kongers have lost their right to self-determination. And so by the 1980s, actually between 1982 and 1984, the colonial power, which was Great Britain and the PRC, had negotiated behind closed doors of Hong Kong's future. And their agreement was a transfer of sovereignty from the UK to China by 1997.
The visit of, or the opening to China by Richard Nixon played an interesting dynamic in the decision by the UN to remove it from the list.
Yeah, so, I mean, the PRC was established in 1949, and it was during the early days of the Cold War, and understandably, America did not recognize the PRC as a legitimate country because it wished to contain the spread of communism. And so it had always recognized the ROC, the Republic of China, which is Taiwan, until President Richard Nixon decided to establish diplomatic relations with China, with mainland China. And so he and his national security advisor and later Secretary of State Henry Kissinger engineered this sort of what they called the ping pong diplomacy to establish the relations with the PRC, and that sort of opened the possibility for the PRC to join the UN as a member state. And as a result, the PRC did join in October. Well, a resolution was passed in October 1971, and they formally joined in November of 1971. And so the interesting thing is that, you know, just 4 months after the PRC had joined the UN, its ambassador to the UN, Huang Hua, had requested the Special Committee of Decolonization to remove Hong Kong from the list of non-self-governing territories, as I was saying earlier. So, I mean, so there's this, it all comes together. So with President Nixon's intention to establish and to recognize the PRC and therefore allowing it to enter the UN, and then subsequently with China's request to remove Hong Kong from that list, and therefore, you know, making Hong Kongers lose the right to self-determination.
So in a way, the Nixon recognition gave them leverage in the United Nations to open that trap to gain control of Hong Kong. Talk about the roots of current campaigning for at least the autonomy and democracy that were promised by Beijing, particularly the importance of the Tiananmen Square massacre, increasingly erased from official Chinese history, as we discussed just recently on this podcast.
There are obviously very similar parallels one can draw between, for example, the Umbrella Movement in Hong Kong 2 years ago and the Tiananmen Massacre of 89. I mean, you know, during the early days of the Umbrella Movement, protesters were genuinely worried that this would, you know, turn into another Tiananmen Massacre with the use of not just pepper spray, but also with tear gas, and that is a really rare scene in Hong Kong, and so people were rightly worried, but it turned out to be peaceful, generally peaceful on both sides. So that was good, but I mean, obviously there are also deeper connections between the Umbrella Movement and the Tiananmen protests of 89, in that they were mostly led by student protesters at the time, and they demanded greater freedom, greater autonomy, greater, you know, degree of democracy from Beijing, from the same regime. And unfortunately, I would have to say, though, at this point, the Umbrella Movement has not been successful in allowing Hong Kong to achieve genuine universal suffrage from the Beijing regime, just as the Tiananmen protests of 89 had not successfully led to a democratized China.
And well, moving from protest, how do you see the political approach taken by Joshua Wong and pro-democracy forces from several parties that actually won 30 seats in the 70-member Legislative Council, now minus the two who were blocked, I guess?
It is a good thing to see the results of the Legislative Council election this year in Hong Kong with, as you said, 30 out of the 70 seats, on the pro-democracy side, which of course encompasses different groups and political parties with, you know, varying degrees of how they wish to have autonomy in Hong Kong from Beijing, the 70 seats in Hong Kong's legislature is actually only 35, which is half of it, are directly elected by the people, and within the 35. Just forget about the two. Well, assuming the two now disqualified candidates have not been disqualified, then out of the 35, 19 was actually won by the pro-democracy side and only 16 by the pro-Beijing side. So it's clear that Hong Kongers are electing more pro-democracy politicians to represent them in the legislature than they do for the pro-Beijing ones. But then, despite always winning the majority of votes, the pro-democracy camp has not been able to gain a sort of majority in the legislature itself, because only half are directly elected. And so I think, I mean, on the long run, I think, you know, there really has to be a change in the system to allow the will of the people to be genuinely heard. with respect to this particular election itself, you know, the results are actually good, because compared to, you know, 4 years ago in 2012, actually more seats have been won on the pro-democracy side. Three more, actually, because it was 27 from the election of 2012. So the pro-democracy camp has grown and has expanded, and it now also encompasses a bigger spectrum. I mean, the two recently disqualified candidates, as we were just talking about, they are the more sort of pro-independence-leaning candidates, and also for Joshua Wong's party, Democisto, its chairman, Nathan Law, has won a seat at age 23, actually, as the youngest legislator in Hong Kong's history, and he does not advocate independence, but he, along with two other newly elected members of the legislature, advocate self-determination. So self-determination and independence, these voices have not previously been heard prior to the Umbrella Movement. So they're new political discourses, and respectively, you know, the people representing these voices have been elected into the legislature, and I think that's a good sign, because that means the legislature is responding to the changes in political discourse among the people.
How and why did you and Joshua Wong settle on a new parallel historical approach to the struggle? How does it empower future action?
Part of what we advocate is self-determination, and the concept of self-determination, as I was saying earlier, was actually, you know, first introduced, or as it is understood today, first introduced with the establishment of the United Nations after World War II, and it really came into global prominence during the 1960s, which was an era of global decolonization. And the idea behind it was that all colonized people have the right to decide their future, so whether they would achieve independence or whether they would join another existing state or form some kind of alliance, different kind of political imaginations was possible, but the prerequisite was the consensus of the people themselves, and that, you know, is lacking. That was, you know, that right was removed from Hong Kongers, and the reason for, you know, tracing back to history was nothing but the failure of one country's two systems itself. I mean, the arrangement by the British and the Chinese negotiators of the 80s was that Hong Kong would remain unchanged, its capitalist system would remain unchanged, its freedoms would not decline for 50 years from 1997 onward. Next year is 2017, so it will be only 20 years next year. But so far, you know, so many has already changed. So many things have already changed. As you introduced in the beginning, you know, there were the adaptation of five booksellers in Hong Kong who sold books critical of the Beijing regime. There's also clear signs of eroding freedoms, be they press freedom, freedom of speech, academic freedom. And so it is the clear signs that one country, two systems is failing, because Beijing's intrusion and intervention into so many of Hong Kong's affairs, as it is not supposed to, that has led to us, you know, that has led us into questioning whether the current arrangement, the current system of one country, two systems, is legitimate in the first place. And it is with that in mind that we started looking back into history and understanding how Hong Kongers were supposed to have the right to self-determination, but which was wrongly removed from Hong Kongers in the 1970s and in the 1980s. And so, you know, an understanding of the past, I believe, is crucial to talking about self-determination today, which is also about the future.
We mentioned the leverage that President Nixon gave China by recognizing it, and the degree and the speed with which they then pressured the Special Committee on Decolonization to remove Hong Kong. You were surprised by initial reaction in the international media and even in Hong Kong itself.
Before talking about the international media, of course, I just would like to add that I think the Nixon administration's intention to establish diplomatic relations with the PRC is not necessarily bad in terms of from a sort of global peacekeeping perspective, it is always good to have friends than enemies. But the problem, of course, is, as you said, that once the PRC had joined the UN, there hasn't been significant efforts to block its request to remove Hong Kong from the list of non-self-governing territories, and you know, the U.S. certainly had the power to do that. I don't think it exercised it, and of course, even more responsible than the Americans, I would argue, are the British and the Portuguese themselves, because the British were the ones who colonized Hong Kong, and the Portuguese were the ones who colonized Macau, and they were in the best position to object to China's sort of classification of Hong Kong and Macau as its own territory rather than as colonies, but they didn't. And the interesting thing is that actually that between 1971 and 1973, so during this time when everything happened, the American ambassador to the UN was future President George H.W. Bush. Hmm. And so the resolution to replace ROC with the PRC, actually it was bundled together. So one vote for removing ROC and then replacing with the PRC, but it was actually Ambassador Bush who had proposed in the General Assembly itself that that the two should be voted separately. So President, Ambassador Bush wished to retain ROC in the UN while admitting the PRC, which would have been a better outcome, I would argue. But his proposal was blocked by the General Assembly. So altogether it was subject to one vote, and Ambassador Bush actually voted no to the resolution. So he ended up voting not for the PRC to join the UN because he didn't want the ROC to be replaced. But obviously that didn't matter because the resolution did end up passing, and then leading to the PRC's admittance in the UN, which then of course led to its pressure on the Special Committee of Decolonization to remove Hong Kong from the list of non-self-governing territories. So the role that the U.S. had played, the Nixon administration certainly set the stage for the international recognition of the PRC, but what Ambassador Bush at the UN did was actually, he actually tried to voice a certain disagreement with the PRC's with the arrangement of removing ROC at the while admitting the PRC, but of course he didn't do as much when it came to objecting the declassification of Hong Kong as colonies. And with your point about the international media, you're certainly right in that there was not a lot of coverage about this problem. When Huang Hua, the Chinese ambassador to the UN, wrote to the chairperson of the Special Committee of Decolonization about removing Hong Kong from the list, I believe it was March 8th of 72, the New York Times actually reported it, and it was probably one of the handful of newspapers that gave any attention, and they did no follow up. And more importantly, with the media in Hong Kong itself, did not report it. So Hong Kong during 1972 was no longer classified or no longer understood or no longer defined by the international community as a colony. So there was a change in its status according to the UN, and yet there is no coverage about it within Hong Kong itself, and one could only assume that Hong Kongers did not know about this arrangement, which happened all within the UN General Assembly, half the world away in New York City, and so the problem being that because it was not known then, it is not known today either, or not widely known today either. So part of what Joshua and I wanted to do in the article we wrote for the World Policy Journal, and also our other work, is to educate and is to inform people around the world, and of course also within Hong Kong, about this forgotten history.
For too long, you argue, Hong Kong has been depicted as little more than a global finance hub, notably part of the New York-London-Hong Kong network that Time magazine dubbed Nylon Kong. And you see clear signs of a transition on the island to a post-materialist age.
Neoliberalism, capitalism, these are very much deeply rooted in Hong Kong's culture. And Hong Kong is undoubtedly a global financial center that is vital to 21st century, commerce, trade, and I don't think these are likely to go away in the future, but the idea is that I think for the generation of young people, which of course include Joshua and myself, I think while we recognize that neoliberalism and capitalism as sort of inherent core values of Hong Kong, what we are also seeing is that materialist pursuits are not the goal in life. So they may be important, they may not be important, but in addition to material pursuits, it seems like we are now moving to a sort of post-materialist era where values such as democracy, autonomy, human rights, freedom, they are also what our generation treasures. And this I think is new because, Hong Kong prior to 1997 was a colony and Hong Kongers did not have the right to exercise any power or any representation beyond casting a vote in the legislature, which is designed to be controlled by the elites anyway, as half of the seats are not directly elected. And so it is sort of like a common ideal or a consensus among older generations that you can live a good life if you do not touch politics. You could get a job, become a professional, earn money, buy a house, buy a car. These, as much as these are important, the new generation seems to be saying, this is not enough. We have to worry about our future, and we of course have to worry about the present. And part of that I think has a lot to do with the experience of this generation. I mean, both Joshua and myself and our generation are born in the 1990s. So our upbringing saw a transition of Hong Kong from a British colony to a Chinese special administrative region. And at least for myself, part of my childhood and part of growing up is witnessing the downfall of Hong Kong, as I was talking about, the erosion of freedoms in different levels, and just reading about the news every day that Beijing is again interfering Hong Kong to a great extent. And I think these experiences and seeing these changes really have led to our values, the change in our values.
But at least as far as Beijing is concerned, isn't the strongest case for autonomy and democracy on the island that without it, China would see far less international economic activity, income, and leverage?
I think you're absolutely right in that. Not even to Beijing, but to the world. How do we make a case for the international community to care about Hong Kong? Well, the easiest answer is to emphasize Hong Kong's importance in the global capitalist system. I mean, to convince Washington to conduct, its foreign policy with regard to Hong Kong, for example, would mean having to convince them that, Hong Kong is vital to American business interests. So, as I was saying earlier, I don't think it is possible, nor is anyone trying to, replace or overthrow Hong Kong's capitalist system or to sort of, rebel against that. I think neoliberalism is too rooted in the culture of Hong Kong to ever go away. But it is the emphasis that as much as economic activity is important, So are, you know, stuff like democracy, autonomy, human rights, and also, you know, why are so many international corporations, transnational corporations, you know, having or setting up offices or headquarters in Hong Kong? Well, that has a lot to do with Hong Kong's strategic interest to them, because it is one foot into the Chinese market, but also Hong Kong has been able to retain its difference, you know, most notably the rule of law, which is otherwise not seen in the rest of China. So there really is a case to be made that preserving rule of law or preserving autonomy in Hong Kong benefits Hong Kongers, of course, but also benefits, you know, the global financial network and the capitalist system.
What are your expectations, hopes, and fears as far as pressure from the U.S. Congress, as Senators Rubio and Cotton have proposed, and from the very ambiguous Donald Trump as president?
It's just November now, so it's Donald Trump has been elected earlier this month to be the next president of the United States, and it hasn't been that long, but, you know, so far he has already... it seems like he has already turned back his campaign promises to, for example, go after, you know, Hillary Clinton, his opponent, and also turn back on his promise to his voters to repeal Obamacare. So I think what we can see from these shifts is nothing but the inconsistency of Trump's sort of proposed policies during his campaigning and what he actually plans to do as president. So I think it is tremendously difficult at this point to see what his policy regarding China or even regarding Hong Kong will be. And I will speak for myself in saying that I am worried about Trump's isolationism or alleged isolationism, in which he seems to be advocating a withdrawal of the United States in different arenas of the international community, for example, NATO or other trade deals, and his idea being that he has to put America first. And the worry, of course, is that, you know, he will not uphold the American commitment to helping the world, you know, different places around the world to advance democracy or advance human rights. But I think at this point it is still too soon to speak about, you know, what his presidency may mean, and I think we have yet to see. And with regard to the bill that you were talking about, proposed by Senators Rubio and Cotton, so they are both Republican senators, and the Republicans will have control in both houses of Congress starting next year. So the prospect of passing it, at least at this point, I think is optimistic. Although certainly, I don't think as activists from Hong Kong, we should limit our call for American support of democracy in Hong Kong to the Republican side of Washington. I mean, I think, and I really do hope that, as I was talking about, you know, upholding values, universal values such as human rights and democracy, is really what is for, you know, as a foreign policy direction of the United States, it's really what both parties can agree on. And so I think it will be nice to have Republican support, but it will be even nicer to have both the Republicans and the Democrats to support it, and I think that will be the case, and I hope that will be the case, but we won't know until next congressional year, because I doubt it will pass with the time remaining this congressional calendar.
But you and Joshua did go down to Washington and lobby on both sides of the aisle in regards to this bill.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Last week, actually, Joshua and I went down to Washington. And we actually met with four members of Congress. Two of them were, of course, Senators Rubio and Cotton, who co-sponsored the bill. But we also had the great opportunity to meet with Democratic House Leader and former Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, and also Representative Waltz from Minnesota. And the feeling that we get is that, you know, supporting an autonomous Hong Kong is, in fact, a bipartisan consensus, and you know, I really do hope that is reflected when the bill is, you know, again introduced on the Senate floor and on the House floor next congressional year.
Jeffrey, no, thank you.
It's great speaking with you.
Umbrella Movement leader Joshua Wong and Hong Kong colleague Jeffrey Ngo, now a master's degree candidate in global history at New York University, co-authored the World Policy Journal article headlined "Reclaiming Our Right to Self-Determination in Post-Umbrella Hong Kong." Days after we spoke, President-elect Trump dramatically challenged China's sense of sovereignty, for better or worse, by accepting a quietly prearranged call of congratulations from the president of Taiwan, the first female leader it has ever elected, ironically, given Trump's bitter battle against Hillary Clinton. Not since 1979 has there been direct communication between leaders of the United States and Democratic Taiwan, which Beijing considers merely a special province under its One China policy, though the U.S. maintains commercial and military connections there. There was speculation that Trump might even meet the Taiwan president next month in New York, on her transit stop en route to Guatemala that the Obama State Department refused to block as China requested. Trump sent a more sympathetic signal by announcing as his ambassador to Beijing Iowa's longtime GOP governor, Terry Branstad, who has extensive ties to China and a friendship with President Xi dating back to 1985. Featured in the WPJ fall issue, History's Ghosts, you'll find articles on what lessons from history keep being forgotten, on silencing the echoes of Tiananmen, and on the decline of sovereignty in the Arab world by award-winning Beirut-based columnist and commentator Rami Jikuri. And listen next week when our podcast will consider growing anti-government, anti-globalist, anti-immigrant echoes of the Trump and Brexit campaigns across Europe these days. World Policy on Air is a production of World Policy Journal at the nonprofit World Policy Institute in New York. Editor Christopher Shea, managing editor Yaffa Frederick, podcast producer Matthew DeMello. I'm David Alpern.